Hello, and thanks for joining us at Seen and Unseen Aloud. My name is Natalie Garrett. This is where you get to listen to a curated collection of the editor's top picks from our recent articles. We're here for you when you need to be eyes-free or hands-free, but still want to hear Christian perspectives on just about everything. Scorsese's Fusion by Sonny Tyndall. Since the release of Silence in 2016, film critics have referred to Martin Scorsese's Trilogy of Faith. This term refers to the legendary director's three faith-based movies, a trilogy of films, which was brought to a neat completion by Silence. Or was it? Scorsese recently announced his next project, The Life of Jesus. This will be his fourth film that sits comfortably within the faith category, shattering the neat theory of a trilogy of films. Not only that, this film, which will be an adaptation of a novel of the same name by author Shusaku Ando, who also authored Silence, has officially put an end to a notion that has irked me for some time, that themes of religion and faith are exclusive to just three of Scorsese's 26 films. Into the seventh decade of his long career, it feels as though no cinematic ground has been left uncovered by Scorsese. From a children's film about the awe-inspiring wonder and amazement that cinema offers in Hugo, to an absurdist black comedy with an unassuming philosophical sting, After Hours, to a psychodrama depicting the corrosive effects of isolation and disillusionment eerily predictive of today's incel culture in Taxi Driver. And then there are the films that, at least at first glance, stand in opposition to his signature mobster epics, his aforementioned Trilogy of Faith. Scorsese's first foray into depicting overtly spiritual subject matter was 1988's The Last Temptation of Christ. See Scorsese and frequent collaborator and screenwriter Paul Schrader seek to find and dissect the humanity of Jesus, played by William Dafoe. This film dives headfirst into the complex waters of the Incarnation, asking what it means for Jesus to be both fully man and fully God. Scorsese subsequently creates a portrait of Jesus as a human wrestling with the complexity and ambiguity of his own divinity. His second faith movie sees him delve into the world of Buddhism and non-violence with 1997's Kundun. It is part history lesson, part spiritual exploration, showcasing the life of the 14th Dalai Lama. The film begins with the Dalai Lama being discovered by monks at the age of two and tracks his life as both the spiritual and political leader of Tibet until its annexation by China and his exile to northern India in 1959. Similarly to Last Temptation, it is within the ambiguity of a dual identity that Scorsese finds the narrative thread of the film. While Scorsese's Jesus is caught in the tension of being both God and man, the Dalai Lama must wrestle with his identity as both the political and spiritual leader of a nation amidst a world in constant conflict. Which brings us to the supposed culmination of Scorsese's Trilogy of Faith, 2016's Silence. The film, based on the novel by Shusaku Ando, tells the story of two Catholic Portuguese missionaries in the 17th century Japan. When it comes to the setting and plot of this film, the crucial contextual detail is that, in an attempt to stamp out peasant uprisings, Christianity has been outlawed in Japan. And yet the film sees these two Catholic priests, played by Adam Driver and Andrew Garfield, venture into a land where Christians are being routinely tortured and executed for their faith. Their motivation for doing so is to find their mentor, Father Ferreira Liam Neeson, who has reportedly renounced his faith. Upon their arrival, the two priests are confronted with the reality of the Japanese regime, coming face to face with relentless brutality and violence. And as the narrative unfolds, they become active participants in the fate of other Christian prisoners, for whom the choice to defend or renounce their faith is a choice between life or death. As a result, we witness the priests' personal beliefs, as well as their opinions of Father Ferreira's decision, beginning to change. And there we have it. What the critics would have you believe is Scorsese's trilogy of faith. Well, it is true that these are the only films that directly depict religious subject matter. This theory overlooks the constant presence of religious imagery and themes throughout his entire career. Indeed, there is more to Scorsese's highly stylized Rolling Stones soundtracked bombastic gangster films than this theory would have you believe. To fully expand the religious themes in Scorsese's work would require an entire career retrospective, from his very first film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, 1967, where the young Catholic boy struggles to reconcile his idealisation of the virginal purity of women with the reality of the women in his life, all the way up to his latest feature, Killers of the Flower Moon, 2023. The third act of which is built upon notions of guilt, confession, and forgiveness. Even when Scorsese is telling stories completely removed from faith, he still weaves spiritual content into the fabric of his work. Yet there is one film, and one scene in particular, that I would suggest epitomises the profound influence that Christianity has had on Scorsese's life and work. It is the closing scene of 1980's Raging Bull, a biopic of Italian-American boxer Jake LaMotta, Robert De Niro. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that this stark film about a man who is defined by violence has no spiritual content, nor religious imagery in it. Yet, as the film draws to a close, LaMotta looks at himself in a mirror and recites Marlon Brando's famous "I could have been a contender" monologue from On the Waterfront. And then, as the film fades to black, the only thing left for the audience to expect is the rolling of the credits, an excerpt of John's Gospel fills the screen. So, for the second time, the Pharisees summoned the man who had been born blind and said, "Speak the truth before God, we know this fellow is a sinner." "Whether or not he is a sinner, I don't know," the man replied. "All I know is this. Once I was blind, and now I can see." This movie, which neither centres religion nor cinema in its plot, climaxes with one of the greatest cinematic monologues and ultimately a Bible verse. Why? Because for Scorsese, a man who flirted with entering the priesthood in his younger years and was first exposed to cinema through one of his local priests, the marriage of Catholicism and cinema have defined his life. Therefore, when it comes to the work of Martin Scorsese, it would be impossible to have one without the other. Now that Scorsese himself has explicitly moved beyond the idea of a trilogy of faith, perhaps the critics, and we the audience, should do the same. Beyoncé's Breaking Barriers by Krish Kandaya. I sometimes wake up in a cold sweat with flashbacks of one terrible swimming lesson at school. I had accidentally forgotten to forget my kit, so was forced to face not only the freezing water, but the spouting of ignorant prejudice from my teacher. "Kandaya, you're useless," he said, as I heaved myself out of the pool at the end of the lesson. "Although I guess it's not your fault you can't float like white children. Your bones are heavier. Look at the Olympics. You never see black or Asian swimmers, do you?" I open and closed my mouth a few times, like the fish out of water I suppose I was. But inside I was seething. Being told I couldn't do something made me all the more determined to do it. Back in I jumped. Last week, in another splash aimed at proving people wrong, Beyoncé's magnificent album Cowboy Carter became the first album by a black woman to top the country charts. In her Instagram feed, she said, "The criticisms I faced when I first entered this genre forced me to propel past the limitations that were put on me. It was a brave move." Back in 2016, she had received heated and hate-filled reactions when she performed her song Daddy Issues at the 50th Country Music Association Awards with the country music group Chicks, formerly known as the Dixie Chicks. Many country music fans were outraged, calling it an act of cultural appropriation. One response on social media put it starkly, "She does not belong." But as a Texan who had been brought up around country music, Beyoncé disagreed. She would spend the next 5 years planning her response. Cowboy Carter proves her country credentials beyond all doubt. It's not only about the music. It does three important things that show the world what can be done when faced with barriers of prejudice and ignorance. The album is clearly an act of tribute to trailblazing country artists before her. Beyoncé included notable guest appearances and feature tracks and took the unusual step of sending flowers to all who had inspired her. Beyoncé sent flowers to Mickey Guyton, the first black female artist to be nominated for a Grammy Award in the country category. She also sent flowers to Kay Michelle and featured Tana Adele, Brittany Spencer and Raina Roberts on the Cowboy Carter track Blackbird, a song that Paul McCartney wrote as a response to the case of the Little Rock Nine, a group of African-American schoolchildren initially barred from attending a previously racially segregated school in Arkansas. It took the direct intervention of the then-president Dwight Eisenhower in 1957 to make it possible for these children to attend their school. She also included guest appearances from country music royalty Dolly Parton and Linda Martell, who both introduced songs on the album. Dolly's introduction to Beyoncé's reworking of Jolene is particularly poignant. "Hey Queen Bee, it's Dolly P." The song Jolene sticks faithfully to the guitar riff from the original, but the words and the tone of this song are completely different. Dolly's original Jolene was begging another woman not to take her man from her. But Beyoncé will have none of that. She is full of threat and menace. "I'm warning you, don't come for my man. Don't take the chance because you think you can." As Beyoncé pays her dues to the greats that have gone before her, she also offers a very different picture. She can recognise the past and yet not be imprisoned by it. She can appreciate those who have laid the foundations for a new era, unbound by cruel stereotypes. We don't have to look far to see the way that Western society is splintering. It is becoming harder to find common ground, harder to move from one tribe to another. Beyoncé's album is political in that it is deliberately breaking down a wall and smashing a division. She refuses to accept that there are no-go areas for people of colour. The album feels like Beyoncé's famous baseball bat from Lemonade, but this time it isn't smashing cars, but preconceptions and prejudices instead. There's anger in this record. The first song is American Requiem, and includes the line, "They used to say I spoke too country, and the reaction came. Said I wasn't country enough. If that ain't country, I don't know what is." Full of confidence and rage, she asks over a bed of country music guitar chords, "Can you hear me? Can you stand me?" Beyoncé does not disguise the ironies. The fresh anger and challenge weaves into classical forms and tropes of country music. The artist that some wanted to exclude from the genre tops the charts. The pop icon becomes an iconoclast. The smashing of divisions makes way for the building of something new. It is within living memory of many that black people were prohibited from sitting at the front of a public bus or drinking from the same water fountain as white people. Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter is not just a smash hit, it is a smash down of the boundaries of genre that had excluded her and others. With this boundary smashed, the opportunity is open for others too. For example, there was a recent standout performance at the Grammy Awards watched by millions around the world. The duet between the country star Luke Combs and Tracy Chapman. Luke, a young white man, is part of a new generation of country singers with a huge following. The legendary black artist Tracy Chapman recently turned 60. The joyful performance was particularly touching as the two of them looked genuinely delighted to be singing together. The video went viral and led to a huge uplift in Chapman's sales. The song Fast Car rocketed to the top of the chart some 36 years after it was first released. Cowboy Carter is Beyoncé using her voice and talent to push back against prejudice and push forward into a new era. She is cracking her whip in the temple of the music industry. She's driving out those who have commandeered the space that rightly belongs to those from any and all backgrounds. She is righteously angry at the injustice. She is declaring that country music be reclaimed as a meeting place for all nations to enjoy. When Jesus unleashed the whip against the tables of the money changers in the temple, who were excluding the non-Jews from a space they rightly belonged to, he fiercely declared, "My Father's house is to be a house of prayer for all the nations." He was not only breaking the barriers of the past, but ushering in a new future, a future where everyone could gather together before God on equal footing. Jesus would eventually die on a cross to ensure this free access to God was available to everyone, wherever they were from, whatever they had done, and whatever they looked like. I welcome this album by Beyoncé in that spirit of challenging prejudices, breaking down barriers, and clearing the decks for a new future equally available to all. If only I could have whipped myself into shape, I believe I could have been the Cowboy Carter of the swimming world 40 years ago. We finish with Beyoncé in her own words. "Ain't got time to waste. I got art to make. I got love to create on this holy night. They won't dim my light. All these years I fight. Say a prayer for what has been. We'll be the ones that purify our father's sins. American Requiem. Them old ideas, yeah, are buried here, yeah. Amen. Amen." Don't Try and Cope on Your Own by Catherine Emflett. I did a horrible piece of training at the weekend. You have to do a lot of continual learning if you're a counsellor, and some of it is hard going. This particular session with Cruise, a national bereavement charity, was about self-harm, and it contained sheets and slides and lists of the ways in which people hurt, damage and punish themselves, usually as a way of expressing another kind of pain, or because it's the only thing they can control in a chaotic world. 6 hours of it on Zoom. All of us have topics that we struggle with, areas that we find difficult to contemplate, and self-harm is one of mine. It is so far from my own experience of reality that it makes me feel square and naive and overprotected. Every part of me revolts against it in some way. How terrible that people who are already suffering can find only relief by inflicting further harm on themselves. And some of the injuries are so grievous. Mortifyingly, my main reason on this occasion was an urge to put my fingers in my ears and tell everyone to stop it. Not just the trainer, but the poor souls involved in hurting themselves too. Training can be humbling, in the way it reveals the limits of our own compassion. Clearly, though, telling people to stop it is not an option, however you might feel. So, what to do? Christianity, usefully, offers quite a lot of different options for coping with difficult life stuff. So I started considering some of these as I attended to the trainer. The peaceful, thoughtful series of Lent reflections I've been listening to recently, for instance, might they help? No, not suitable, really. Too meditative. You can't gather the scattered pieces of your consciousness and center them on God. When someone is talking about teenagers cutting themselves in risky places or too deep, I found, tranquility of mind is too passive a response. So then I thought about people talking sometimes of being able to hand over their troubles to Christ. He takest away the sins of the world, as the communion service puts it. His arms are open and he is God, so he can bear the weight. But that didn't work either. Too mystical. It felt as if action was required, not meek handing over of sorrows because I couldn't bear to contemplate them. I don't think we're meant to dodge responsibility and simply go, "Ooh, you have these ones, Lord, because I don't want them." So I sat there, writhing inwardly and feeling sweaty and miserable and wishing I was somewhere else. But then I started wondering how everyone else at Crewe's copes with such things. I began looking at the other faces on my screen, the 21 of my colleagues who were also attending the training, almost all of them volunteers. There was the strong, calm face of Manju, an Indian doctor lady, and Suki, a smiley, gappy-toothed African lady who both work on the triaging team, assessing callers as they come in and assigning them to helpers. There was Richard I and Richard II, both white, both younger than me, one older, both friendly and knowledgeable and kind. There was Naga, a retired nursing sister who looked Scandinavian, and Christina, ditto, except she'd been a teacher. And Nick, not much more than a teenager by the look of him, and Sat, a big brummy taxi driver in a turban. William looked as if he might be an academic, with his leather elbow patches, and Keith had his sound off due to the presence of a large cat on his desk, which leaned over periodically to meow into his mic, and lots of others too. Suddenly I realised that there was my answer. All those good people giving up their Saturday because they cared. Listening to stories of suffering because they wanted to understand better. In order to be able to help better, to do something for the broken and the sad among us. That's the presence of God, surely, that an army of people turn out, day in, day out, to do things simply because they are good. There is no payment, no special recognition. They have to listen to some very difficult things and contemplate darkness they wouldn't necessarily in their own lives. But there they all were that morning. One small group among thousands of others all over the country, no doubt, ready to serve and cheerful and friendly and attentive. They talked matter-of-factly about cases they'd encountered and situations which can lead people to injure themselves and about self-harm as a phenomenon in certain social groups, about how it can be treated, about how it can heal and disappear with the right care and compassion, about how sometimes it can even be preferable to other alternatives. It is much easier, for example, to stop self-harming than it is to recover from an eating disorder. This kind, accepting, unshocked conversation was immensely comforting and reassuring, I found. There was safety in it, and daylight, and hope. A feeling that even if someone is suffering, there are others who are able to meet them there, to keep them warm and hold them up. The people do act as the hands and feet of God, actually, sometimes, regardless of creed or faith or fallenness. Looking at them all, I felt so much better. And that if they can do it, so can I. We only need to work in company together, and our collective strength will keep us all afloat, rescuers and rescued alike. Be not afraid, the Bible says over and over again. It is very much easier not to be when you're not trying to be brave by yourself. Thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, help others to discover it. Leave a review and rate us wherever you get Seen and Unseen Aloud. Help others discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than they might ever have imagined.